As a matter of fact, I asked Kenneth about it just last night. It seemed odd somehow. Since I testified at the first trial, I assumed I'd be called the second time around. I glanced down at Morley's memo, which seemed to indicate they'd had a meeting. We'd better set up an appointment as soon as possible. Hang on a minute and I'll get my book. She put the phone down on her end, and I heard the tap of heels across the hardwood. She returned to the telephone with a rustle of paper. I'm busy this afternoon. What's this evening look like for you? That sounds fine to me. What time? Could we make it 7? Kenneth usually doesn't get home until 9, but I'm assuming you don't need him to sit in. Actually, I'd prefer to have the time alone. Good. Then I'll see you at 7. I tried the clinic next and found myself connected with what I guessed was the reception desk. The person who answered was female and sounded young.
Santa Teresa Medical Clinic. This is Ursa. May I help you?
I said, Can you tell me if you have a Laura Barney working at the clinic?
Mrs. Barney? Sure. Hang on and I'll get her.
I was placed on hold briefly. This is Mrs. Barney. I introduced myself, explaining, as I had with Francesca, who I was and why I was calling. Can you tell me if you talked to Morley Shine in the last couple of weeks?
As a matter of fact, I had an appointment with him last Saturday, but he never showed up. I was very annoyed because I'd canceled some plans in order to make time for him.
Did he give you any indication what he meant to ask?
Not really, but I assumed it was in conjunction with this lawsuit coming up. I was married to the man acquitted of the criminal charges.
David Barney.
That's right. We were married for 3 years.
I'd like to talk to you. Can we set up a time this week?
In the background, I could hear another line begin to ring insistently.
I'm usually here until 5. If you stop by tomorrow, I can probably make some time.
4:30 or 5?
Either one is fine.
Good. I'll stop by as close to 4:30 as I can make it. I'll let you pick up your other call.
She said thanks and clicked off.
I went back to my list and called 9 other names at random. Not one of them had ever heard from Morley Shine. This was not looking good. I buzzed Ida Ruth in the outer office. Is Lonnie still in court?
As far as I know.
What time's he get back?
Lunchtime, he said, but he sometimes skips lunch and heads for the law library instead. Why, what's up? You want to get a message to him?
A low-level dread had begun to churn in my chest. I'd better go over there and have a chat with him myself.
Which courtroom, did he say?
Judge Whitty, Department 5.
What's going on, Kinsey? You sound very strange.
I'll tell you later. I don't want to commit myself quite yet. I walked over to the courthouse, which was only 2 blocks away. The day was sunny and clear, with a mild breeze ruffling the grass on the courthouse lawn. The architecture of the building itself is Mediterranean, complete with towers, turrets, sandstone arches, and open-air galleries. The exterior landscaping is a bright mix of magenta bougainvillea, red bottle brush, junipers, and imported palms. A low-growing fringe of ground cover along the sidewalk threw out a heady perfume. I went up the wide concrete steps through ornate wooden doors. The corridor was empty. The floor was paved with glossy, irregular stone tiles the color of old blood. The lofty ceilings were hand-stenciled and crisscrossed with dark beams. The lighting fixtures were wrought-iron replicas of Spanish lanterns, the windows secured by sturdy grillwork. The place might have been a monastery once, all cold surfaces stripped of ornament. As I passed, the door to the jury assembly room opened and prospective jurors poured out into the hallway, filling the air with the tap-tapping of footsteps and the murmur of voices. Soon I could hear the incessant squeaking of stall doors in the restrooms across the hall. Department 5 was located another 2 doors down the hall on the right, the lighted sign above the door indicating that court was still in session. I eased the door open and slipped into a seat in the rear. Lonnie and opposing counsel were involved in a case management conference, their voices droning on the warm air like big fat bumblebees. The judge was in the process of referring the case to judicial arbitration, setting the dates for both the completion of the arbitration and a future case management conference.
As usual, I wondered how individual fates could be decided through a process that sounded on the face of it so dull. When the judge broke for lunch, I waited by the door, catching Monty's eye as he turned and headed through the little swinging gate that separated the spectators' pews from the court. He took one look at my face and said, "What's the matter?"
"Let's go outside where it's private. You're not going to like this."
We walked side by side without a word, footsteps clattering down the corridor, down the concrete steps, out the front entrance to the sidewalk. We struck off across the grass just far enough to ensure that we wouldn't be overheard. He turned and looked at me, and I plunged in. "I don't know a nice way to say this, so I'll get right to the point. It turns out Morley's files are more than disorganized. Half the reports are missing, and what he's got there is suspect."
"Meaning what?"
I took a deep breath.
"I think he was billing you for work he never did."
Lonnie's face went blank as the news sank in.
"You're shitting me."
"Lonnie, he had a heart condition and his wife is very sick. From what I gather, he was hard up for money, but he didn't have the time or the energy to do much."
"How'd he think he could get away with that? I got a court date in less than a month. Did he think I wouldn't notice?" he asked. "Hell, what's the matter with me? I didn't notice, did I?"
I shrugged. "In the past, from what I've heard, his work was always great." Small comfort to an attorney who could end up in court with nothing in his hand but his dick. Lonnie seemed to pale, apparently conjuring up the same image of himself.
"Jesus, what was he thinking of?"
"Who knows what he was thinking? Maybe he was hoping he could get caught up."
"How bad is it?"
"Well, you still have the witnesses from the criminal trial. It looks like most of them have been subpoenaed, so you're cool on that score. I'm guessing maybe half the witnesses on the new list never heard from him. I could be wrong. All I did was a spot check. I'm really judging by the number of reports I can't find." Lonnie closed his eyes and wiped his face with one hand.
"I don't want to hear this."
"Look, we still have some time. I can go back and fill in, but if we run into a snag, we're up shit creek. Some of these people may not even be available."
"Jesus, this is my fault. I've been tied up with this other matter and it never occurred to me to question his paperwork. What I saw looked okay. I knew he was backlogged, but what he gave me seemed fine."
"Yeah, what's there is fine. It's what's not there that worries me."
"How long will it take?"
2 weeks at the very least. I just wanted you to be aware of what you're up against. With the holidays coming up, a lot of people are going to be tied up or out of town."
"Do what you can."
"At 2, I'm taking off for Santa Maria for a 2-day trial. I get back late on Friday, but I won't come into the office until Monday morning. We can talk about it then."
"Will you be staying up there?"
"Probably. I could come home at night if I had to, but I hate losing the hour drive time each way. After a full day in court, I just want to grab a quick bite somewhere and then hit the sack. Ida Ruth will have the motel number if there's an emergency. In the meantime, do what you can, okay?"
"Sure."
I went back to the office. As I passed Lonnie's office door, I spotted Ida Ruth talking on the telephone. She caught sight of me and waved frantically, motioning me back. She put the party on hold and then put her hand across the receiver, as if to further muffle her side of the conversation in progress.
"I don't know who this guy is, but he's asking for you."
"What's he want?"
"He just read Morley's obituary. He says it's urgent he talk to whoever's taking over for him."
"Let me get back to my desk and I'll pick it up in there. Maybe he's got some information for us. What line's he on?" She held up two fingers. I trotted down the hall, closed the office door behind me, dumped my handbag, and reached across my desk, punching line 2, which was blinking steadily.
"This is Kinsey Milhone. Is there something I can help you with?"
"I read in the paper Morley Shine died. What happened?" The voice was well modulated, the tone cautious.
"He had a heart attack. Who is this?"
There was a pause.
"I'm not sure that's relevant."
"It is if you want to talk to me," I said. Another pause.
"My name is David Barney."
My heart did one of those sudden hard bangs. Excuse me, I'm the wrong person to ask about Morley Shine.
He cut in, saying, Listen to me, now just listen. There's something screwy going on. I talked to him last Wednesday.
Morley called you?
No, ma'am, I called him. I heard some ex-con named Curtis McIntyre is set to testify against me. He claims I told him that I killed my wife, but that's bullshit and I can prove it.
I think we should stop this conversation right here.
But I'm telling you, tell it to your attorney. You have no business calling me. I've told my attorney. I told Morley Shine, too, and look how he ended up.
I was silent for half a second.
What's that supposed to mean?
Maybe the guy was getting too close to the truth.
I rolled my eyes.
Are you implying he was murdered?
It's possible.
So is life on Mars, but it's not likely. Why would anybody want to murder Morley Shine?
Maybe he'd found something that exonerated me.
Oh, yeah, really. Such as what?
McIntyre claims he talked to me outside the courtroom the day I was acquitted, right?
I said nothing.
Right?
He asked again. I hate guys who insist on a line-by-line response.
Make your point, I said. The fucker was in jail then. It was May 21st. Check his rap sheet for that year. You'll see it plain as day. I told Morley Shine the same thing Wednesday morning, and he said he'd look into it.
Mr. Barney, I don't think it's a good idea for us to talk like this. I work for the opposition. I'm the enemy. You got that?
All I want to do is tell you my side of it.
I held the phone out and squinted at the receiver in disbelief.
Does your attorney know you're doing this?
To hell with that. To hell with him. I've had it up to here with attorneys, my own included. We could have settled this years ago if anybody'd had the decency to listen.
This from a man who shot his wife in the eye.
Hey, you have the legal system if you want someone to listen. That's what it's all about. You say one thing, Kenneth Voigt says something else, the judge will hear both sides and so will the jury.
But you won't.
No, I won't listen because it's not my place, I said irritably.
Even if I'm telling the truth.
That's for the court to decide. That isn't my job. My job is to gather information. Lonnie Kingman's job is to put the facts before the court.
What good is it going to do to tell me anything? This is stupid.
Jesus Christ! Someone has to help me.
His voice broke with emotion. I could hear mine getting colder.
Talk to your attorney. He got you off a murder rap. So far, at any rate. I wouldn't mess with success if I were you.
Could you meet with me? Just briefly?
No, I can't meet with you.
Lady, I'm begging you. 5 minutes is all I ask.
I'm going to hang up, Mr. Barney. This is inappropriate.
I need help.
Then hire some. My services are taken.
I put the phone down and jerked my hand back. Was the man nuts?
I'd never heard of a defendant trying to enlist the sympathies of the opposition. Suppose, in desperation, the guy came after me. I snatched up the phone again and buzzed Ida Ruth.
Yes'm?
The guy who just called?
Did you give him my name?
Of course not. I'd never do such a thing, she said.
Oh, shit. I just remembered. I gave it to him myself.
Chapter 9.
I picked up the phone again and placed a call to Sergeant Cordero in Homicide. She was out, but Lieutenant Becker picked up.
Hi, this is Kinsey. I need some information, and I was hoping Sherry could help.
She won't be back until after 3, but maybe I can help. What's the scoop?
I was going to ask her to call the county jail and have someone check the jail release forms for a fellow named Curtis McIntyre.
Wait a minute. Let me grab a pencil.
That was McIntyre?
Right. He's an informant set to testify on a case for Lonnie Kingman.
I need to know if he was incarcerated on May 21st, 5 years ago, which is when he claims he talked to the defendant. I can get the information by subpoena, but it's probably just a wild goose chase, and I hate to go to all the trouble.
Shouldn't be hard to check. I'll call you back when I've got it, but it may take a while.
I hope you're not in any crashing hurry.
The sooner the better.
Ain't that always the way?
Lieutenant Becker said.
Once I hung up the phone, I sat and thought about the situation, wondering if there was a quicker means of verifying the information. I could certainly wait until mid-afternoon, but it would prey on my mind. David Barney's call had left me feeling restless and out of sorts. I was reluctant to waste time checking out what was probably pure fabrication on his part. On the other hand, Lonnie was counting on Curtis McIntyre's testimony. If Curtis McIntyre was lying, we were sunk, especially with Morley's investigation coming unraveled at the same time. This was my first job for Lonnie. I could hardly afford to get fired again. In my head, I re-ran the conversation I'd had with Curtis at the jail. In his account, he'd intercepted David Barney in the corridor just outside the courtroom on the day he was acquitted. I didn't think I could count on Barney's attorney, Herb Foss, to corroborate Curtis's claim. But could there have been another witness to their encounter? Just the countless reporters and their mini-cams and mics. I grabbed my jacket and my shoulder bag. I left the office and dog-trotted the two blocks to the side street where I'd finally managed to squeeze my car into a bare stretch of curb. I took Capilla Boulevard across town, through the heart of the commercial district, and headed up the big hill on the far side of the freeway. KEST-TV was located just this side of the summit. From the bluff where the station sat, there was a 180-degree living mural of the city of Santa Teresa. Mountains on one side, the Pacific Ocean on the other. There was parking for about 50 cars, and I pulled into a spot designated for visitors. I got out of the car and paused for a moment to take in the view. The wind was buffeting the dry grasses along the hill. In the distance, the pale ocean stretched to the horizon, looking flat and oddly shallow. I remembered the story I'd once heard from a marine archaeologist. He told me there was evidence of primitive offshore villages, underwater now, located at the mouths of ancient sloughs or arroyos. Over the years, the sea had offered up broken vessels, mortars, abalone spangles, and other artifacts, probably eroding from former cemeteries and middens along the now-submerged beach. In legend, the Chumash Indians recount a time when the sea subsided and remained that way for hours. A house was exposed at the far reaches of the low tide. A mile out, or 2 miles, this miraculous shanty. People gathered on the beaches, murmuring with amazement. The waters receded further, and a second house appeared. But the witnesses were too frightened to approach. Gradually the waters returned, and the two structures vanished, covered by the slow swell of the incoming tide. There was something eerie about the tale. Holocene ghosts offering up this momentary vision of a tribal site lost from view. Sometimes I wondered if I'd have dared venture out across that stretch of exposed channel. Perhaps half a mile out, it plunged downward like the sides of a mountain, underwater cliffs tumbling ever deeper to the canyon below. I pictured the sediment on the ocean bottom glistening, dead gray from the lack of light, cobbled and pockmarked with all its blunt and stony treasures. Time covers the truth, leaving scarcely a ripple on the surface to suggest all the plains and valleys that lie below. Even now, dealing with a 6-year-old murder, much was hidden, much submerged. I was left to gather artifacts washed up like rubble on the shores of the present, uneasy about the treasures, undiscovered, lying just out of reach. I turned and went into the station. The building itself was a 1-story stucco structure, painted a plain sand color, bristling with assorted antennae. I went into the lobby with its pale blue carpeting, furnished with a kind of Danish modern furniture an affluent college student might rent for a semester. Christmas decorations were just going up. An artificial tree in one corner, boxes of ornaments stacked in a chair. On the wall to my right, numerous broadcast awards were mounted like bowling trophies. A color television was tuned to a morning game show, the gist of which seemed to be identifying a series of celebrities whose first names were Andy. The receptionist was a pretty girl with long dark hair and vivid makeup. The name on the placard read Tanya Alvarez.
"Rooney," she called, her eyes pinned to the set.
I turned and looked at the picture.
Andy Rooney was correct, and the audience was applauding. The next clue came up, and she said,
"Oh, shoot, who is that? What's his face? Andy Warhol."
Right again, and she flushed with pleasure. She looked over at me.
"I could make a fortune on that show, except probably the day I got on it'd be some category I never heard of, blowfish or exotic plants. Can I help you?"
"I'm not sure. I'd like to look at some 5-year-old news footage if you have it."
"Something we taped?"
"That's what I'm assuming. This was the verdict on a local murder trial, and I'm pretty sure you'd have covered it."
"Hang on a minute, and I'll see if somebody back there can help you."
She rang through to somebody in the bowels of the building, briefly describing the nature of my request.
"Leland'll be out in 5 minutes," she said.
I thanked her and spent the mandatory waiting period wandering from the front entrance, which looked out into the parking lot, to the sliding glass doors on the far side of the reception area, which looked out onto a wide concrete patio furnished with molded white plastic chairs. A 3-dimensional view of the city wrapped around the patio like a screen. I could imagine the station employees having lunch out in the hot sun, women with cotton skirts discreetly pulled up, men without shirts. A big dish antenna dominated the view. The air looked hazy from up here.
"I'm Leland. What can I do for you?"
The fellow who'd appeared through the doorway behind me was in his late 20s and had to be 100 pounds overweight. He had a mop of curly brown hair surrounding a baby face, with wire-rimmed glasses, clear blue eyes, flushed cheeks, and no facial hair. With a name like Leland, he was doomed. He looked like the kind of kid who'd been tormented by his schoolmate since the first day of school. Too bright and too big to avoid the involuntary cruelties of other middle-class children. I introduced myself and we shook hands. I explained the situation as succinctly as possible. What occurred to me was that, with local reporters present on the day Barney was acquitted, there were probably minicams rolling as he emerged from the courtroom.
"Okay," he said.
"Okay" wasn't really the response I was looking for, Leland. I was hoping you had a way to go back and check the old news tapes. Leland gave me a blank look. I wish a PI's job were half as easy as they make it look on television. I've never opened a deadbolt with a pass of my credit card. I can't even force mine into a door jamb without breaking it off. And what's it supposed to do once you slide it in there? Most of the latch bolts I've seen, the slanted angle is on the inside, so it's not as though you could slip a credit card along the face of it and force the latch to move back. And where the angle faces the outside, the strike plate resists the insertion of even the most flexible object. Leland seemed to be taking the same implacable position. "What's the matter? Don't you keep that stuff?"
"It's not that. I'm sure there's a copy of the footage you're looking for. The master tapes are cataloged by subject matter and date, cross-referenced and cross-filed on 3x5 index cards."
"You don't have it on computer?"
He shook his head, with just a hint of satisfaction.
"The logistics of the system don't really matter much because I can't let you see the master tape without a properly executed subpoena."
"I'm working for an attorney. I can get a subpoena. This is no big deal."
"Go ahead, then. I can wait."
"Yeah, well, I can't. I need the information as soon as possible."
"In that case, you got a problem. I can't let you see the master tape unless you have a subpoena."
"But if I could get it eventually, what difference does it make? I'm entitled to the information. That's the bottom line, isn't it?"
"No ticky, no washy. That's the bottom line," he said.
I was beginning to see why his imaginary classmates liked to torture him. "Could we try this?" I pulled out a mugshot of Curtis McIntyre. "Why don't you look at the tape and tell me if he's on it? That's all I want to know."
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
"Could we try this?" I pulled out a mugshot of Curtis McIntyre. Why don't you look at the tape and tell me if he's on it? That's all I want to know.
He stared at me with that blank look all petty bureaucrats assume while they calculate the probabilities of getting fired if they say yes.
Why do you want to know? I really wasn't listening before.
This fellow claims he had a conversation with the defendant in a murder trial shortly after he was acquitted. He says the cameras were rolling as the guy left the courtroom. So, if what he says is true, he ought to be clearly visible on the tape, right?
Yes, he said slowly.
I could tell he thought there was some kind of trick to it.
This isn't a violation of anybody's civil rights, I said reasonably. Could you just look?
He held out his hand. I gave him Curtis's mugshot. He continued to hold his hand out. I stared for a moment. Oh, I said. I opened my handbag and took out my wallet. I peeled off a 20 and put it in his palm. His expression didn't actually change, but I knew he was insulted. I'm sure it's the same look you'd get from a New York taxi driver if you tipped him a dime. I peeled off another 20. No reaction. I said, I really hate corruption in someone so young.
It's disgusting, isn't it? He replied.
I added a third. His hand closed.
Come with me.
He turned and headed back through the doorway and into a narrow corridor. I followed without a word. Offices opened up on either side of us. Occasionally, we passed other station employees wearing jeans and Reeboks, but no one was doing much. The spaces seemed cramped and irregular, with too much knotty pine veneer paneling and too many cheaply framed photographs and certificates. The whole interior of the building had been done up with the sort of do-it-yourself home improvements that later make a house impossible to sell. At the rear, we passed into a tiny concrete cul-de-sac with a wood and metal stairway leading up to an attic. Just to the right was an old-fashioned wooden file cabinet with a smaller wooden file sitting on top. He opened the drawer for the year we wanted and began to sort through the index cards, starting with the name Barney.
We won't have the actual field tapes, he remarked while he looked.
What's a field tape?
That would be like the whole 20 minutes of tape the guy shot. We keep the 90 seconds to 2 minutes of edited footage that actually goes on the air.
Oh. Well, even that would help.
Unless the guy you're looking for stepped up and spoke to your suspect after the cameras finished rolling.
True enough, I said.
Nope, nothing, he said. Well, let's see here. What else could it be under?
He tried murder, trials, and courtroom cases, but there was no reference to Isabel Barney.
Try homicides, I suggested. Oh, good one.
He shifted to the H's. There it was, with a numerical designation that apparently referred to the number of the tape on file. We went up the narrow stairs and through a door so low we were forced to duck our heads. Inside there was a warren of tiny rooms with 6-foot ceilings, lined with video cassette containers, neatly labeled and filed upright. Leland located and retrieved the cassette we were looking for, and then led me downstairs again and around to the right where there were 4 stations set up with monitoring equipment. He flipped on the first machine and inserted the tape. The first segment appeared on the screen in front of us. He pressed fast forward. I watched the news for that year whiz by like the history of civilization in 2 minutes flat, everybody very animated and jerky. I spotted a still of Isabel Barney. There she is, I yelped. Leland backed the tape up and began to run it at normal speed. An anchor person I hadn't seen for years was suddenly doing the voiceover commentary as snippets of the case, neatly spliced together, spelled out the highlights of Isabel's death, David Barney's arrest, and the subsequent trial. The acquittal, in condensed form, had the speedy air of instant justice, well edited, swiftly rendered, with liberty for all. David Barney emerged from the courtroom looking slightly dazed.
Hold it. Let me look at him.
Leland stopped the tape and let me study the image. He was in his 40s, with light brown wavy hair combed away from his face.
His forehead was lined, and there were lines radiating from the corners of his eyes. He had a straight nose and a tense grin over artificially even teeth. His chin was strong, and I could see that he had strong hands with blunt-cut nails. He was slightly taller than medium height. His attorney looked very tall and gray and somber by comparison. "Thanks," I said. I realized belatedly that I'd been holding my breath. Leland pushed play, and the coverage quickly switched to another subject altogether. He handed me Curtis McIntyre's mugshot.
"No sign of him."
For the money I'd given him, he could have feigned disappointment.
"Could it be the camera angle?" I asked. "We got a wide and a close. You saw him come through the door alone. Nobody approached in the footage we caught. Like I said, the guy might have stepped up and spoken once the press conference was over." "Well, thanks," I said. "I guess I'll have to rely on my other source." I went back to my car, not sure what to do next. If I got verification of Curtis McIntyre's incarceration, I intended to confront him. But I couldn't do that yet. In theory, I had numerous interviews to conduct, but David Barney's phone call had thrown me. I didn't want to spend time shoring up David Barney's alibi, but if what he said was true, we'd end up looking like a bunch of idiots. I took the winding road down the back side of the hill and turned right on Promontory Drive, following the road along the ocean and through the back entrance to Horton Ravine. I used the next hour and a half canvassing the old neighborhood to see if anybody had been out and about on the night Isabel was murdered. It didn't thrill me to be in range of David Barney, but I couldn't see a way around it and still get the information I wanted. A canvass by telephone is the same as not doing it. It's too easy for people to hang up, tell fibs, or shine you on. One neighbor had moved and another had died. A woman on the adjacent property thought she'd heard a shot, but she hadn't paid much attention to the time, and she'd later wondered if it hadn't been something else. Like what, I thought. I wasn't sure if it was my paranoia or not, but any time I heard what sounded like a gunshot, I checked the clock to see what time it was. Of the 8 remaining homeowners variously peppered along that stretch of road, none had been out that night, and none had seen a thing. I got the impression that it had all happened far too long ago to bear worrying about at this point. A 6-year-old murder doesn't engage the imagination. They'd already told their versions of the story one too many times. I went home for lunch, stopping off at my apartment just long enough to check for messages. My machine was clear. I went next door to Henry's. I was looking forward to meeting William. I found Henry standing in his kitchen, this time up to his elbows in whole wheat flour, kneading bread. Pellets of dough clung to his fingers like wood putty. Usually Henry's kneading has a meditative quality, methodical, practiced, soothing to the observer. Today his manner seemed faintly manic, and the look in his eyes was haunted. Beside him, at the counter, stood a man who looked enough like him to be a twin. Tall and slim, with the same snowy white hair and blue eyes, the same aristocratic face. I took in the similarities in that first glance. The differences were profound and took longer to assimilate. Henry wore a Hawaiian shirt, white shorts and thongs, his long limbs sinewy and tanned as a runner's. William wore a 3-piece, pinstriped suit, a starched white shirt, and a tie. His bearing was erect, nearly stiff, as if to compensate for the underlying feebleness I'd never known Henry to exhibit. William held a pamphlet in a slightly shaking hand, and he pointed with a fork to a drawing of the heart. He paused for introductions, and we went through the proper litany of inaugural sentiments. "Now, where was I?" he asked.
Henry gave me a bland look.
"William's been detailing some of the medical procedures associated with his heart attack." "Quite right. You'll be interested in this," William said to me. "I'm assuming your knowledge of anatomy is as rudimentary as his."
"I couldn't pass a test," I said.
"Nor could I," William replied, "until this episode.
Now, Henry, you want to pay attention to this.
I doubt that, Henry said.
You see, the right side of the heart receives blood from the body and pumps it through the lungs, where carbon dioxide and other waste products are exchanged for oxygen. The left side receives the blood full of oxygen from the lungs and pumps it out into the body through the aorta.
The diagram he was using looked like the road map of a park with lots of one-way roads marked with black and white arrows.
Block these arteries, and that's where you have a problem.
William tapped on the diagram emphatically with the fork.
It's just like a rock slide coming down across a road. All the traffic begins to pile up in a nasty snarl.
He turned a page in the pamphlet, which he held open against his chest like a kindergarten teacher reading aloud to a class. The next diagram showed a cross-section of a coronary artery that looked like a vacuum cleaner hose filled with fluffies.
Henry interrupted. Have you had lunch?
That's why I came home.
There's some tuna in the refrigerator. You can make us some sandwiches. Do you eat tuna, William? I've had to give it up. It's a very fatty fish to begin with, and when you add mayonnaise?
He shook his head.
Not for me, thanks. I'll open one of the cans of low-sodium soup I brought with me. You two go ahead.
Turns out William can't eat lasagna, Henry said to me.
Much to my regret. Fortunately, Henry had some fresh vegetables I was able to steam. I don't want to be a bother, and I said as much to him. There's nothing worse than being a burden to your loved ones. A heart condition doesn't have to be a death sentence. Moderation is the key. Light exercise, proper nutrition, sufficient rest. There's no reason to believe I couldn't go on into my 90s.
Everyone in our family lives into their 90s, Henry said tartly. He was slapping loaves into shape, plunking one after another into a row of greased pans. I heard a dainty ping. William removed his pocket watch and flipped the case open.
Time for my pills, he said. I believe I'll take my medication and then have a brief rest in my room to offset the stress of jet lag. I hope you'll excuse me, Miss Milhone. It's been a pleasure meeting you.
Nice to meet you too, William. We shook hands again. He seemed somewhat invigorated by his lecture on the hazards of fatty foods. While I put the sandwiches together, Henry put 6 loaves of bread in the oven. We didn't dare say a word because we could hear William in the bathroom filling his water glass, then returning to his room. We sat down to lunch.
I think it's safe to say this is going to be a very long 2 weeks, Henry murmured.
I moved over to the refrigerator and took out 2 Diet Pepsis, which I brought back to the table. Henry popped both tops and passed one back to me. While we ate, I filled him in on the investigation, in part because he likes hearing about the work I do, and in part because I find it clarifies my thinking when I hear what I have to say.
"What's your feeling about this Barney fellow?" he asked.
I shrugged. "The man's a creep, but then I don't think much of Kenneth Voight either. Talk about grim." Fortunately for them, the judicial system doesn't seem to hinge on my personal opinions.
You think the informant is telling the truth?
I'll know a lot more when I find out where he was on May 21st, I said.
Why would he lie? Especially when it's so easy to check. From what you've said, if he was actually in jail, all you have to do is go back and look at his paperwork.
But why would David Barney lie about it when the same possibility applies? Apparently, nobody's thought to verify the date so far.
Unless Morley Shine checked it out before he died.
Henry imitated the significant moment music on a radio drama.
Da-da-da.
I smiled, mouth too full of sandwich to articulate a reply. Oh, great. That's all I need, I said when I could. I do my job right, and I die too. I wiped my mouth on a paper napkin and took a sip of Pepsi.
Henry gestured dismissively. Barney's probably generating some kind of smoke screen.
I hope that's what it is.
If some of this shit checks out, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Famous last words. Before I left, I put in a call to Lieutenant Becker to see if he'd heard from inmate records.
I just got off the phone with them. The guy was right. Curtis McIntyre was being arraigned that day on a burglary charge. He might have passed Barney in the hall on his way to see the magistrate, but he'd have been shackled to the other prisoners. There's no way they could have talked.
I better find out what's going on here, I said.
You better do it quick. McIntyre got out of jail this morning at 6.
Chapter 10. I headed back to the office and called Sergeant Hickson, a friend of mine out at the jail. She checked Curtis McIntyre's records and gave me the address he'd provided his last parole officer. Curtis seemed to spend a portion of each year taking advantage of the rent-free accommodations provided by the Santa Teresa County Sheriff's Department, which he probably considered the equivalent of a Hawaiian condominium vacation timeshare. When he wasn't enjoying the free meals and volleyball at the local correctional facility, he apparently occupied a room at the Thrifty Motel. Daily, weekly, monthly, kitchens. On Upper State Street. I parked my VW across the road from this establishment, which quick calculation told me was within walking distance of the jail. Curtis didn't even have to spring for a taxi on release. I imagined that his was that one room without a ratty car parked out front. The occupants of the other units boasted Chevys and 10-year-old Cadillacs, vehicles favored by auto insurance defrauders, which is what they might have been. Curtis hadn't been out of jail long enough to engage in any illegal activities. Well, maybe littering, lewd conduct, and public spitting, but nothing major. The Thrifty Motel looked like the sort of auto court where Bonnie and Clyde might have holed up. It was L-shaped, built of cinder block, and painted the strange green that yolks turn when they've been hard-boiled too long. There were 12 rooms altogether, each with a tiny porch a little bigger than a doormat. Someone had planted marigolds in matching coffee cans arranged in twos and threes by the front steps. The office at the entrance was dominated by a Coke machine, and the front window was obscured by mock-ups of all the credit cards they took. I was just about to cross the road and verify his presence when I spotted him emerging from the very room I'd mentally assigned him. He looked rested and freshly shaved, wearing jeans, a white T-shirt, and a denim jacket. He was in the process of running a comb through his hair, which was damp from the shower, and formed a curly fringe around his ears. He was simultaneously smoking and chewing gum, a refreshingly aromatic combination for the breath. I fired up the VW and followed at a distance. I kept him in sight as he headed west, passing numerous small businesses. A pizza parlor, a gas station, a U-Haul rental, a home improvement emporium, and a garden shop. Beyond these, where the road curved around to the left, was a combination bar and grill called the Wander Inn. The door was standing open. Curtis flipped his cigarette toward the pavement and disappeared through the front. I pulled into the gravel parking lot around at the back and left my car in one of 10 empty slots. I entered the rear door, passing the restrooms and the kitchen, where I could see the fry cook shaking the oil from a wire basket piled with golden fries. The interior of the bar was all polyurethane and beer smell, illuminated by a wide shaft of daylight coming in the front. Already, the cigarette haze gave the room the misty quality of an old photograph. The only colors I could see were the vibrant primary hues of the pinball machine, where a cartoon space woman with big conical breasts straddled the earth in a form-fitting blue space suit and thigh-high yellow boots. Behind her, a big red dildo-shaped spaceship was just blasting off for the moon. At the bar, 6 men turned to look at me, but Curtis wasn't one. I spotted him in a booth, a beer bottle to his lips, Adam's apple thrusting up and down like a piston. He set the empty bottle on the table and paused to produce several noisy burps in succession, like a furious sea lion barking at his mate.
A waitress in a white blouse, black slacks, and crepe-soled deck shoes emerged from the kitchen with a tray of hot food, which she took to his booth. I waited until he'd been served a cheeseburger and a mound of fries, all of which he doctored with liberal doses of salt and ketchup. He piled lettuce, tomato, pickle, and onion on the burger, put the top of the bun back, and mashed it into place. He had to hold it with both hands in order to bite in. I approached the booth and slid into the seat across from him. He expressed as much enthusiasm as he could muster with his mouth full and his lips smeared with ketchup.
"Hey, how are you? This is great. Glad to see you. I don't believe this. How'd you know I'd be here?"
He swallowed his cheekful of burger and wiped the bottom half of his face with a paper napkin. I handed him a second napkin from the dispenser and watched him as he cleaned up his fingers, after which he insisted on shaking hands with me. I didn't see a polite way to refuse, though I knew my palm would smell like onions for an hour afterward. I folded my arms, leaning on my elbows, to discourage any further contact.
"Curtis, we have to talk." "I got time. You want a beer? Come on and let me buy you one."
Without waiting for assent, he signaled the bartender by holding up his beer bottle and two fingers.
"You want some lunch, too? Have some lunch," he said.
"I just ate."
"Well, have some fries. Help yourself. How'd you know I was out? Last time you seen me, I was in jail. You look great."
"Thanks, so do you. That was yesterday," I pointed out. Curtis popped up and crossed to the bar to get the beers. While he was gone, I ate a couple of his French fries. They were wedge-cut, with the skins on, and perfectly cooked. He returned to the booth with the beers, and I saw him make a move as if to slide in on my side.
"No way," I said.
He was acting like I was his date, and I could see the guys at the bar begin to eye us with speculation. I refused to give him room, and he was forced to sit down again where he'd been. He handed me a beer and grinned at me happily. Curtis seemed to think that along with all the beer, cigarettes, and saturated fats, he might just get lucky and get laid this afternoon. He put his chin in his fist and tried his soulful puppy dog gaze on me.
"You're not gonna be mean to me now, are you, hun?"
"Finish your lunch, Curtis, and don't give me any more of that hangdog look. It just makes me want to hit you with a rolled-up newspaper."
"Damn, you're cute," he said.
Love had apparently diminished his appetite. He pushed aside his plate and lit a cigarette, offering me a drag like we were post-coital.
"I'm not cute at all. I'm a very cranky person. Now, could we get down to business? I'm having a little problem with the story you told me."
He frowned to show he was serious.
"How come?"
"You said you sat in on David Barney's trial."
"Not the whole thing. I told you that. Crime might be exciting, but the law's a bore, right?"
"You said you talked to David Barney as he left court just after he'd been acquitted."
"I said that?"
"Yes, you did."
"Don't remember that part. What's the problem?"
"The problem is you were in jail at the time, waiting to be arraigned on a burglary charge."
"No," he said with disbelief. "I was?"
"Yes, you were."
"Well, I'm burnt. You got me there. I forgot all about that. I guess I got my dates wrong, but the rest of it is gospel."
He held his hand up as if he were taking an oath.
"Swear to God."
"Cut the horseshit, Curtis, and tell me what's going on here. You didn't talk to him. You're lying through your teeth."
"No, wait, just wait. I did talk to him. It just wasn't where I said."
"Where then?"
"At his house."
"You went to his house?"
"That's baloney. When was this?" "I don't know. Couple weeks after his trial, I guess."
"I thought you were still in jail."
"Nah, I was out by then with time served and all that. My attorney cut a deal. I like cop to the lesser plea."
"Forget the jargon and tell me how you ended up at David Barney's house. Did you call him or did he call you?"
"I don't remember."
"You don't remember?" I said in a scathing tone of skepticism. I was being rude, but Curtis didn't seem to notice. He was probably accustomed to being addressed that way by all the hard-nosed prosecuting attorneys he'd faced in his short, illustrious career.
I called him.
How'd you get his telephone number?
Called information.
What made you think to get in touch with him?
It seemed like to me he wouldn't have many friends. I've been there myself. Get in trouble with the law, a lot of people won't fool with you much after that. It's like they don't want to hang out with a jailbird.
So you thought he needed a best friend and you were going to be it. What's the rest of it? His response was sheepish, and he had the good grace to squirm.
Well, now, I knew where he lived, out in Horton Ravine, so I figured he was good for a meal or a couple drinks. We'd been cellmates and all, and I thought he'd at least be polite.
You went to borrow money, I said.
You might put it that way.
So far, it was the only thing he'd said that rang true.
I just got out. I didn't have no funds to speak of, and this guy had lots. He's loaded.
Skip that, I believe you. Describe the house.
He's living in the dead wife's house by then, up a hill, Spanish, with this courtyard and a terrace with this big black-bottom swimming pool.
Got it. Go on.
I knock on the door. He's there, and I say I was in the area and stopped by to congratulate him on getting off a murder rap. So he asks me in, and we have a couple drinks.
What did you drink?
He had some kind of pussy drink, vodka tonic with a twist. I had bourbon straight up with a water back. It was classy bourbon, too.
So you're having drinks.
That's right. We're having these drinks, and he's got this little old gal in the kitchen making up a tray of snacks. That green stuff. Guacamole and salsa and these triangle-shaped chips that are gray. I said, what the hell are them? And he said, they're blue corn tortilla chips.
Looked gray if you asked me.
We sat there and drank and carried on until almost midnight.
What about dinner?
Wasn't any dinner. Just snacks is all, which is how we got so loaded.
And then what?
And that's when he said what he said about he done her.
What did he say exactly?
Said he knocked on the door. She come downstairs and flipped on the porch light. He waited until he seen her eye block the light in the little peephole. Then he fired away. Boom.
Why didn't you tell me this story to begin with?
It didn't look right, he said righteously. I mean, I went up there to ask if he'd lend me some money. I didn't want it to seem like I was mad he turned me down. Nobody'd believe me if I told the story that way. Besides, he was nice about it, and I didn't want to look like a dick. Pardon my French.
Why would he admit he killed her?
Why not? Once he's acquitted, he can't be retried.
Not in criminal court.
Shoot, he's not going to worry about a damn civil suit.
And you're prepared to go into court with this?
I don't mind.
You will testify under oath, I said, trying to make sure he understood what this was about.
Sure. Only, you know.
Only you know what?
I'd like a little something back, he said.
As in what?
Well, fair is fair.
Nobody's going to pay you money.
I know that. I never said money.
Then what?
I'd like to see a little time off my parole. Something like that.
Curtis, nobody's going to make a deal with you. I have no authority whatsoever to do that.
I never said make a deal, but I could use some consideration.
I looked at him long and earnestly. Why didn't I believe what he was telling me? Because he looked like a man who wouldn't know the truth if it jumped up and bit him. I don't know what made me blurt out the next question. Curtis, have you ever been convicted of perjury?
Perjury?
God damn it, you know what perjury is. Just answer the question and let's get on with this. He scratched at his chin, his gaze not quite meeting mine.
I never been convicted.
Oh, hell, I said. I got up out of the booth and walked away from him, heading for the rear of the restaurant. Behind me, I could hear him spring to his feet. I glanced back in time to see him fling some bills on the table as he hurried after me. I stepped out into the parking lot, nearly recoiling from the harsh sunlight on the white gravel.
"Hey, now wait up. I'm telling you the truth."
He grabbed at me, and I pulled my arm out of reach.
"You're going to look like crap on the stand," I said, without breaking stride. "You've got a record a mile long, including charges of perjury."
"Not charges, just the one. Well, two if you count that other business."
"I don't want to hear it. You've already changed your story once. You'll change it again the next time somebody asks. Barney's attorney is going to tear you apart."
"Well, I don't see why you have to take that attitude,"
he said.
"Just because I told one lie doesn't mean I can't tell the truth."
"You don't even know the difference, Curtis. That's what worries me."
"I do know."
I unlocked my car door and opened it, rolling down the window to break the airlock when I shut it. I got in the front seat and slammed the door smartly, nearly catching his hand on the doorpost where he was resting it. I reached over and flipped open the glove compartment. I got out one of my business cards and thrust it through the window at him.
"Give me a call when you decide to tell the truth."
I started the car and pulled away from him, flinging up dust and gravel in my wake. I drove back to the office with the radio blasting. It was 3:35, and of course parking was at a premium. It didn't occur to me that with Lonnie driving up to Santa Maria, his space would be free. I circled the area, increasing one block with each round, trying to snag a spot within reasonable walking distance of the office. Finally, I found a semi-questionable slot, with my rear bumper hanging out into somebody's driveway. It was an invitation for a parking ticket, but maybe all the meter maids had gone home by then. I spent the rest of the afternoon doing busy work. My appointment with Laura Barney was coming up within the hour, but in truth I was marking time until I had a chance to talk to Lonnie, who Ida Ruth kept assuring me was temporarily out of service. I found myself loitering in the vicinity of her desk, hoping I'd be nearby if he should happen to call in.
"He never calls when he's working," she said patiently.
"Don't you ever call him?"
"Not if I'm smart. He gets annoyed when I do."
"Don't you think he'd want to hear about it if his prime witness turned sour?"
"What does he care? That's this case. He's tied up doing something else."
"I've worked for him 6 years, and I know what he's like. I can leave a message, but he'll just ignore it until this trial is over with."
"What am I supposed to do till he gets back? I can't afford to waste time, and I hate spinning my wheels."
"Do whatever you want. You're not going to get anything from him until 9 o'clock Monday morning."
I glanced at my watch. This was still Wednesday. It was 4:05.
"I've got an appointment near St. Terry's in half an hour. After that, I think I'll go home and clean house," I said.
"What's with the cleaning? That doesn't sound like you."
"I spring clean every 3 months. It's a ritual I learned from my aunt. Beat all the throw rugs, line dry the sheets."
She looked at me with disgust.
"Why don't you go on a hike up in Los Padres?"
"I don't hang out in nature if I can help it, Ida Ruth. There are ticks up in the mountains as big as water bugs. Get one of those on your ankle, it'd suck all your blood out. Plus, you'd probably be afflicted with a pustular disease."
She laughed, gesturing dismissively. I dispensed with a few miscellaneous matters on my desk and locked my office in haste. I was curious about David Barney's ex-wife, but somehow I didn't imagine she'd enlighten me much. I went downstairs and hoofed it the 3.5 blocks to my car. Happily, I didn't have a ticket sitting on my windshield. Unhappily, I turned the key in the ignition, and the car refused to start. I could get it to make lots of those industrious grinding noises, but the engine wouldn't turn over. I got out and went around to the rear, where I opened the hood. I stared at the engine like I knew what I was looking at. The only car part I can identify by name is the fan belt. It looked fine. I could see that some little doodads had come unhooked from the round thing. I said, "Oh." I stuck 'em back. I was just getting in the front seat when a car pulled halfway into the drive. I tried the engine, and it fired up.
Can I help?
The guy driving had leaned across the front seat and rolled the window down on the passenger side. No, thanks. I'm fine. Am I blocking your drive?
No trouble. There's room enough. What was it, your battery? You want me to take a look?
What was this? The engine was running. I didn't need any help.
Thanks, but I've already got things under control, I said.
To demonstrate my point, I revved the engine and shifted into neutral, temporarily perplexed about which way to go. I couldn't pull forward because of the car parked in front of me. I couldn't back up because his car was blocking my rear. He turned his engine off and got out. I left mine rumbling, wondering if I had time to roll up my window without seeming rude. He looked harmless enough, though his face was familiar. He was a nice-looking man in his late 40s, with light brown wavy hair graying at the temples. He had a straight nose and a strong chin. Short-sleeved t-shirt, chinos, deck shoes without socks.
You live in this neighborhood? He asked pleasantly.
I knew this guy. I could feel my smile fade. I said, You're David Barney. He braced his arms on the car and leaned toward the window. Subtly, I could feel the man invading my turf, though his manner remained benign.
Look, I know this is inappropriate. I know I'm way out of line here, but if I can just have 5 minutes, I swear I won't bother you again.
I studied him briefly while I consulted my internal warning system. No bells, no whistles, no warning signs. While the man had annoyed me on the telephone, up close and personal, he seemed like ordinary folk. It was broad daylight, a pleasant middle-class neighborhood. He didn't appear to be armed. What was he going to do? Gun me down in the streets with his trial a month away? At this point, I had no idea where